Welcome to University Drive, your pathway to the transformational work of University of the Bahamas. Our goal is to build a better Bahamas by shaping tomorrow's leaders today, finding solutions to challenges, and forging new opportunities for growth. University Drive, where faculty, staff, students, and alumni travel the road of progress together with you. What lies beneath, sometimes what we do not readily see, holds great worth and value nonetheless. Hello everyone, I'm Tamika Lundy and this is University Drive. In this edition of University Drive, we are taking you into a fascinating conversation and exploration of the hidden natural treasures beneath the surface with a very specific focus. Caves and blue holes are extraordinarily important to mankind. In the Bahamas, they provide groundwater, contain rare and endangered biodata, and often significant historical and archaeological artifacts. Our guest on this episode is doing a compelling research project entitled Price Calculation for Non-Market Tourist Sites, with special emphasis on caves and blue holes in New Providence. Associate Professor of Geography at University of the Bahamas, Dr. Mark Stevens. Welcome to University Drive.
Hello, Ms. Lundy. It's nice to be here with you.
Well, it's very good to have you here. Why don't you tell our listeners a bit about your background and your connection with University of the Bahamas and as a researcher?
Sure. Well, it goes back some time to when I grew up and got interested in the natural landscapes. I'm from England originally, and I grew up looking over some hills and valleys. So I got interested in geography. And following my studies, I was lucky enough to do a doctoral project on the island of Borneo in Southeast Asia. And that was studying the third largest cave in the world called Nia Cave. And it's an important archaeological site. Although my background is not archaeology, it's in physical geography. And the archaeologists wanted a geographer to do some investigations and tell them, you know, how old is the archaeology using geological methods? What was the environment and climate like 40,000 years ago at Nia Cave? And then following that experience, I've continued to work in the tropics. So my first professorial job was at University of the South Pacific in Fiji, and I studied some geographical projects there, including a cave called Voli Voli Cave that had important fossil remains. It's actually the most important site in Fiji. And I worked with the local communities there to help develop the site, including, we call it geoconservation, where we try and improve the conservation. So in that particular site, the archaeology was being washed away by a stream that was flowing down into the cave, and only because of deforestation of the slopes. So through some project funding, we were able to implement a drainage channel to divert the water away from the fossil deposits, and then also to install footpaths, an information panel designed by students. And so I got really interested in this idea of, you know, protecting, developing, conserving, promoting geological sites. And that site in Fiji, it's really succeeded. You know, they've had a lot of tourists visit the site, and the local landowners, you know, they're doing very well with it. And subsequent to that, I worked at the University of Botswana, and there I also did some projects on some of the caves there and gorges, some of which had not been documented before. So, you know, as you mentioned, I quite enjoy trying to find these sites and then trying to help with the conservation, promotion, education. And that leads me I've been working at the University of the Bahamas in 2018 and continuing these kind of projects.
So it seems that the very nature of what you do is about probing and uncovering and adding to our treasure trove of information.
Oh, yes, certainly. It's trying to find out more about what's here and getting students involved and sparking their interest as well. And sometimes even a student might tell me about a site that I don't know about. So that's been really useful also.
I've always been fascinated and intrigued about what is man's relationship with his natural environment? What's our motivation? What's our relationship with this environment that we've been blessed with? Are we taking care of it? Are we being good stewards of it? What does your research say? What does your research and experience say? How would you respond to that?
That's a great question. And it kind of varies around the world, our approach. Definitely, though, humankind, we seem to get very interested and curious about these unique places like caves. There's something symbolic about it. For example, in Fiji, there's a myth that a pregnant lady should never enter a cave. And then there's lots of, in the Bahamas, the myth of the mermaid. So like in Golden Gates, there's the mermaid's pool. And we associate with mythological kind of supernatural kind of phenomena. And also, you mentioned stewardship. So, and I think that's got a bit confused. Obviously, with the push for development around the world, which has really raised human living standards in the past century and the last few decades. At the same time, though, it's come at the cost of environmental degradation. And so that's the real challenge of the modern day: is how do we also maintain living standards for people, but also without damaging the natural environment, and also preserving habitats for animals and plants. And you might be aware that in the Bible, for example, it does mention dominion over the environment. And I'm not sure if we perhaps misinterpreted that as dominate, although there are many other parts of the Bible that talk about preserving and protecting.
So recently, you were announced as one of the latest cadre of researchers to be receiving the prestigious Wilson Award. And your research project relates to, and I'm so interested in how you're going to do this, but it relates to price calculations for caves and blue holes in New Providence. How did you come to such a research topic, and how will you actually conduct this kind of research?
Yeah, it's another great question. I came to this topic through obviously my interest in caves and blue holes, and also trying to find where they are all located on New Providence and the ones that are also known on other islands. And I'd done a previous project on the disturbance of caves and blue holes on New Providence. So I've got a good idea of where they're located. And then I taught a course at UB on the valuation of natural resources. So I got fascinated in, how do we value the natural environment, and particularly things that are not on the market, because, we cannot go to the supermarket and buy a cave or a blue hole. So, how do we know how valuable they are? Whereas other things you can, it's possible to go and buy timber from a forest. Those kinds of things have been valued. So, I think it's a fascinating area. And also, I think if we know the real value of something, then I think it helps us to understand it better and appreciate it. And but obviously some things, it might be really difficult to value it. Imagine looking at a beautiful view of a sunset over the ocean with palm trees blowing in the wind. Can we put a price on that? And yeah, it's an interesting area.
Quite interesting. And I believe I know where the three blue holes are in New Providence, but tell our listeners where they all are.
Okay, I'll give you a few examples. Obviously, in terms of caves, there's Caves Point Caves, that's quite well known. There's the Banana Hole Cave in Clifton Heritage Park, and there are several other caves along the coast near Clifton. There are some small caves near to the Fox Hill Blue Hole, and that's in an area of forest. There's a Blue Hole in Golden Gates. There's one in Colony Village Estates. So yeah, there's a few dotted around. I've counted around 9 blue holes. And some of them are in more natural areas, like the one near Coral Harbour Road. That's quite a beautiful area. Although, yeah, there are challenges, of course, of urbanisation and obviously finding enough land areas for people to live. So that's been part of the work I've been doing.
And the other blue holes we have on the island, I know that there's one by R.M. Bailey School. There's one in Golden Gates Community. I think there's one at Primeval Forest, I believe.
There's certainly in Primeval Forest, there is a deep hole, but it doesn't have water in it. I'm sure it had water in it in the past. And there's certainly some caves in the Primeval Forest. Apparently, there's one off the trail there that has bats in it.
Ah, it had water before. What accounts for that? What contributes to that?
It's just with the change in groundwater levels. So in the past, that would have been full with water, and just the groundwater levels change over time, and that also relates to changing sea levels.
So how are you going about this research study? How are you really delving into a price calculation for what you call these non-market tourist sites?
There are different ways of doing it. And the approach that I've chosen, along with my colleague, who's an economist, Professor Cook, at Husson University in America. So, you know, I'm a geographer, she's an economist. We can really assist each other in developing this project. So essentially, we need to find out from people that are visiting these sites, you know, how do they value it? So in that way, we call it a stated preference approach. You know, we're getting people to state their preference on things like what is their willingness to pay. That's part of, they call it neoclassical economics. It's tied in with supply and demand. So we've developed a series of questions that we can ask them. Now, of course, most of the sites on New Providence, there is no entrance fee. So, I mean, that would be an obvious place to start for us, except the Primeval Forest has got an entrance fee. Clifton Heritage Park has an entrance fee, although people might not specifically be going there to see the caves. It might be just that, you know, that's one of the one of several attractions there. So, yeah, it's essentially a list of questions in relation to, you know, what they're willing to pay, what would they be willing to pay, for example, for the site to be conserved, or even to pay as an entrance fee. How much did people pay to actually travel to the site? So these are quite well-established methods for environmental resources. So, yeah, essentially asking people that visit these sites, it's mostly tourists. I think for somewhere like Caves Point Caves, I think people come typically on a package from a cruise ship, but also locals visit there as well.
Which leads me into the next question, which is, how do you imagine the findings of your research being used? Do you anticipate the information and the knowledge being used to impact public policy, the development of tourism, any kind of community-based initiatives?
Yeah, that's really important, isn't it? For the work to, you know, to be spread with, shared with the different stakeholders. So certainly, you know, when we finish the project, will intend to publish it, and then it would be, the results would be publicly available then, but also to present it at forums such as Research Edge at University of the Bahamas, and also to reach out to people that, you know, it would be of interest to them, like the Bahamas Tourist Organization and people involved with the sites, and obviously and through the students, through their contacts, you know, for people. So, for example, at the Fox Hill Blue Hole, which is a wonderful site. I mean, that it's that the forest there is really pristine. It reminds me of the primeval forest, and there's a wonderfully large blue hole there, and obviously a local community surrounding the site. So there's really great potential there for that to be perhaps used for ecotourism or geotourism. And I know there are, you know, local people that visit the site and, you know, could even act as guides. Although, of course, there are issues with access to the sites and, you know, speak with landowners, all of that kind of thing. And so, yeah, it would have to be communicated sensitively and with a spirit of, you know, education and kind of, yeah, promoting conservation.
As far as you know, is your research particularly groundbreaking? And if so, in what ways? Because really, in my view, any new knowledge that we create about our natural environment that has the potential to make us better informed about how to conserve and manage them is certainly important.
Yeah, that's it's another insightful question. I think it is groundbreaking, or it will be. I mean, you know, the research is still in progress. And I say that because this kind of work's not been done before in the Bahamas, or only minimally, certainly for caves and blue holes. It has been done for other natural resources, you know, the valuation of things like tidal creeks, coral, seagrass, forests, beaches, mangroves. But as I said, for caves and blue holes, much less so. And it's something that hasn't really been studied much around the world in general. When we did a literature review with, it was actually my student, Miss Hannah, that did this wonderful literature review of this kind of study from around the world. And there's only a few studies out there, such as there's a couple of studies from Spain, there's one from the Philippines, one from Australia. And so, yeah, it would really add to the literature and our kind of knowledge and helping us to improve valuation of these resources.
And what stage are you at in your research? Because I believe that you're also using some student or a student as a part of your research team. And that is also important for knowledge transfer and experience and developing capacity. What stage are you at?
Oh, yeah, for sure. So obviously we devised the project. We did a proposal. You know, we were very delighted to receive the Wilson Award. So we've mainly done, you know, desk-based studies and some reconnaissance. And so I had a student, Miss Hannah, she completed a project, and that included a literature review, some reconnaissance survey, and studying, you know, pre-existing kind of, for example, membership rates for the BNT to sites, and, you know, trying to tease out, you know, how much of that could be for caves and blue holes. Miss Hannah devised this survey at around over 20 questions, and with another student now, Miss Burrows, she's managed to streamline that down to about 11 questions. And so we're kind of at that point where we're kind of raring to go and speak to the people using the caves. We've applied for a research permit in relation to, you know, ecological, biological resources, and that's in progress. So hopefully we can obtain that and begin the work quite soon.
So what led you to begin in New Providence? Was it a question of access? And do you anticipate another research study that delves into the blue hole valuation pricing system approach to blue holes in islands outside of New Providence?
Yeah, so initially, obviously, I'm living and working in Nassau, so that's something I noticed. I was going through an atlas of the Bahamas, looking at the maps, and then I was looking at the map of New Providence, and I could see these blue holes, and it just struck me. I just thought, wow, that's interesting, because I'd not really heard about them. And I noticed that there were quite a few. So I started on weekends, just making road trips, trying to visit some of these sites, or, you know, at least trying to find them. And obviously I was aware of the really famous ones, like Dean's Blue Hole on Long Island, you know, the second deepest in the world. And Andros has got a large concentration. And then I'd visited Primeval Forest, which has got one of the largest concentrations of sinkholes in the world. And then Loch Ayan Caves in Grand Bahama, which has got one of the longest cave systems in the world. So I kind of had an idea that I'm in a very interesting location for studying this phenomena. Now, the server we've devised is mainly about sites in New Providence, but there are also questions relating to sites elsewhere that, for example, tourists might have visited. So yeah, we're hoping also to, you know, to tease that out through the surveys. You know, how much are people willing to pay or are paying to visit these sites? See what we get in the results. And you know, as with any research, it tends to be, you know, when you get results, always new questions arise, and so most likely, you know, we'll want to maybe get more specific about certain sites, and maybe including some of those more famous sites.
I happen to believe, and tell me if I'm wrong, but that there's a level of urgency in research studies like yours because of the various threats that these natural environments are under. Are you of the same view?
Absolutely, yeah. You know, I'm a geographer, an environmentalist, and, you know, caves and blue holes, it's something that, you know, I've done a lot of research in. It's something, you know, I'm passionate about, and I try to share that passion with the students, and some have got really interested in it. And also just through their own interest, you know, they've approached me and said, you know, they want to do projects in this area. Yeah, for example, during the COVID lockdowns, you know, on those occasions when we were allowed to go out and about, I did notice a lot of development happening on the island, you know, a lot of clearance of forest on the ridges, and, for example, around the Coral Harbour Road Blue Hole. You know, you can see that on Google Earth, the changes that have just happened in the last 3 years. I understand that, you know, there is also a shortage of land area for housing. But for example, you know, the Blue Hole in Golden Gates, you know, it's beautiful, and it is in a park. Although, you know, I think there is potential with these kind of sites to be like at the Primeval Forest, before an area becomes too urbanized, you know, to protect it with a fence, have an entrance fee, so that there's some kind of sustainable income, and also, you know, protection of the habitat, and a kind of a place for people to go and refresh on a weekend, to, you know, spend some time in nature. And like I mentioned, this Coral Harbour Road Blue Hole, I think that's certainly got that kind of potential. Obviously, Nassau, you know, it's the capital city. It's got the highest population in the Bahamas. If I was to compare it with anywhere, in terms of size, with another kind of capital city, it would be Singapore. The island of Singapore is only a little bit larger than New Providence, and it's got 5 million people. And now they've managed to build upwards. And I don't know if that's realistic in the Bahamas, and taking into account hurricanes. But, you know, the protection of natural sites, it's obviously important, and it is referred to in the National Development Plan of the Bahamas, the Vision 2040. So, you know, it is part of the national agenda, and it's just trying to find that balance, isn't it, between you know, human development and nature conservation, and obviously, you know, we can't live without nature. It provides our ecosystem services. Yeah, it's the challenge for this century. not just for the Bahamas, the whole planet. It's, you know, this is a big challenge.
And right at the intersection of how we act and what we do and how we plan is the higher education systems of the world, like University of the Bahamas, and its researchers and faculty who develop the kind of knowledge that we can all use so that we can live more sustainably and make wiser decisions and choices moving forward. This is a good place for us to take our break. You're listening to University Drive. We'll be back with more after this.
Are you ready to take your knowledge or career to new heights? Don't wait to invest in your future. Do it now. How? Earn a professional development certificate from University of the Bahamas. Whether you're looking to enhance your leadership abilities, sharpen your technical skills, or explore a new field entirely, our Continuing Education and Lifelong Learning Center has the ideal course for you. We offer single-phase electrical, ethics in procurement, accounting for entrepreneurship, stop managing, start leading, dynamic presentations, digital marketing, superior customer service, and justice of the peace. We even have courses on smartphone photography, TikTok videos, defensive driving, and interacting with difficult people. Or open the door to new languages with English as a second language, conversational Chinese, and Spanish in the workplace. Our instructors are experts in their fields, and they're here to support you every step of the way. Call us at 302-4449. Enroll today.
Chapter One Bookstore is proud to serve the students, faculty, and staff of the University of the Bahamas and the community at large. We are the premier choice for the purchase of university textbooks and supplies and UB logo apparel, paraphernalia, and gifts. We also carry a wide variety of school supplies, learning aids, and leisure books. Visit our copy center for all of your printing, copying, and binding needs. Chapter One Bookstore is located on the ground floor of the Michael H. Eldon Complex on University Drive. Shop with us on Monday through Saturday. You can contact us at 397-2650 or email at chapter1@ub.edu.bs. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Chapter One Bookstore. Chapter One, the premier choice.
Here we are back on University Drive. We have as our guest, Dr. Mark Stevens, and we're having a very interesting conversation on the economic impact of caves and blue holes in the Bahamas, which is a research study that he is working on right now at the moment. Dr. Stevens is one of the recent awardees of the Wilson Award grant for his research. Dr. Stevens, what I'm interested in is, given the increasing threat of climate change, what kinds of things do we need to bear in mind about our caves and blue holes, not only in the Bahamas, but around the world? Because you've done work on these systems in Fiji as well as Botswana, and now you're here in the Bahamas as a faculty member at UB, engaged in a research study on caves and blue holes in New Providence. So what have you found? What have you seen? And what do we need to pay particular attention to?
Yeah, that's another great question. Thank you, Ms. Lundy. What's interesting about caves and blue holes is that they're actually formed through things like major climate changes. Blue holes themselves tend to be formed from, for example, in the last ice age, sea levels were 120 meters lower. But, you know, that's going back about 20,000 years in time. And then with this decreased sea level, you've got groundwater also over 100 meters lower that's going to be cutting and creating caves, you know, beneath our feet during the last ice age. And then subsequently, the ceilings of the caves have kind of collapsed in over, you know, several thousands of years. And then you basically see the on the surface, the, you know, basically, it's like a sinkhole that's collapsed inwards. And caves, you know, think about the sea caves on the coast, these kind of horizontal passages, you know, they're created by erosion of the waves, but also at the intersection of groundwater And you know, caves, point caves have been formed in that manner. So you know, we get landforms created from you know, these natural processes. You know, the rocks at the primeval forest and caves, point caves. You know, you might notice that they're dry now, but they were formed at a time of higher sea levels in the past. And then things like blue holes, they fill in with sediment over hundreds and thousands of years. So some scientists actually take a core of that sediment and study the layers, looking at environmental history. For example, looking at the frequency of hurricanes going back hundreds or thousands of years. And those kind of studies have been published for the Bahamas. There was something, some kind of work I did for my PhD on the cave in Borneo, where I looked at, I studied some fossil mollusk shells, kind of snail shells, and used geochemical methods to analyze the growth layers. And I could get a record of what rainfall was like several thousand years ago. So you can get this really detailed information. And then think about like the stalagmites and stalactites in caves. These kind of, they look like icicles, these kind of sharp, pointy kind of draperies on the within a cave on the ceiling or the floor. And even those, you know, they can be sawn in half. And again, the growth layers in those can be analyzed with geochemistry. And those kind of studies have been done around the world. So they actually contain, you know, they're created from major environmental changes, and then they also contain records or archives of environmental change. So they are valuable to us scientifically, naturally, aesthetically, educationally, ecologically.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I see your research as having benefits, not only in terms of the knowledge and the education, but also raising awareness of the state of these natural sites and what their benefit are to the way that we live. I don't know if a lot of people actually know where all of the caves and blue holes are on New Providence who actually live here. I don't know if we are sufficiently concerned or aware or care about conservation and protecting them and proper management of them the way that we should.
Yeah, that's right. So yeah, that's part, definitely part of the research, you know, the educational side and promoting awareness of them. Some caves and blue holes have been damaged. The if we look at the 1 to 25,000 map of New Providence from the 1970s, there's a cave they call Hunt's Cave that's labeled. That sadly got bulldozed at some point in the last couple of decades. But it has been documented. You know, it was reasonably large. It had bats. It could have been, you know, an interesting site. And as you mentioned, to the use of these sites, not only for, you know, revenue, but also, which can be significant, by the way, and I could say more about that. But for example, when I visited the Blue Hole in Colony Estates on the eastern side of New Providence, you know, I was speaking to a local resident there, and she said, "Oh, you know, I'd just love to, on a Sunday afternoon, just to go and sit next to the Blue Hole. It gives me such peace." So, you know, there is something about these sites. You know, they're so unique, and it attracts birds as well, and you know, they've got fish, and yeah, certainly a natural beauty.
So would your study have any implications for, let's just say, community-led initiatives related to the economic use of blue holes and caves, perhaps?
Definitely, and that was the project I did in Fiji. Was, you know, I worked directly with the community. However, you know, they were the landowner. They owned the land that the cave was on, and it was known in the academic literature as the most important fossil site in Fiji. And it had previously been used for things like tourism, ecotourism, maybe 10 years previously. But like I said, there'd been some deforestation on the slopes. Then it just wasn't really being used for anything. And but definitely the locals were really keen to manage it and for it to be something for their community to be the stewards of and to pass on to, you know, next generations, and also to get, you know, some sustainable revenue without damaging the site from ecotourism. So here in New Providence, you know, I've been kind of looking out for similar projects. Although it's, you know, it's a different context because in terms of, you know, the ownership of the sites now, as I'm aware, that the caves and blue holes are all protected. They're officially kind of under the ownership of the government. However, the land surrounding them might not be. And so, you know, quite a few of them are privately owned. You know, it'd be interesting to maybe contact some of the landowners in a way, maybe to suggest, you know, how about maybe, you know, they could be used for this or that in terms of, you know, ecotourism, conservation. Because some of the sites are not really being used for anything, and perhaps people, as you mentioned, might not be aware of, you know, the benefit they could be to local communities in terms of, you know, being proud of living next to such an interesting site. And I remember one local resident at Fox Hill, he was, you know, saying how he's been visiting the Blue Hole since he was a young boy. And he said he had quite an interesting experience with the bird life there. You know, it was such a startling experience, such a, you know, in terms of the nature there. And you know, he keeps going back to visit there. So definitely, you know, the community do have an interest. And yeah, it could, you know, it can provide employment as well. Through the management of sites, through, you know, guided tours and souvenirs, and just with the management of these sites.
And this is why your this kind of research study can help to inform things like a national development plan, particularly when you talk about factors like urbanization and then the built environment and all of these considerations. They all go hand in hand, don't they? Because we should be all about wanting to make better, more wiser choices and decisions and implement policies that are reflective of things like blue holes and caves and natural sites that mean so very much to us and our way of life.
Oh, definitely, yeah. You know, it's the natural heritage. I think that there has been mainly a focus on beaches and coral reefs. You know, that they're a bit more visible and tourists kind of flock to those, but tourists and residents are also interested in things inland. And there are these wonderful sites inland, some of which, you know, have been kind of swamped by the urban sprawl that's happened on New Providence and in all cities around the world in the last few decades. And it's kind of, but there are some sites that still haven't being consumed as yet and can still be saved and preserved. And yeah, it does take, you know, the willpower of the decision makers and people associated with those land areas to do that, because there might be some, you know, immediate economic benefits of clearing land areas for housing projects. But there can also be a longer-term benefit of a cave or a blue hole if it's preserved and conserved, as I say, for heritage, for, you know, just being part of the consciousness of the nation. And also some of these sites can be, you know, can create a very large revenue. You know, some of the most popular caves and blue holes in the world. I can give you some examples. Mammoth Cave in Kentucky gets 2 million visitors per year. I just think about the revenue with that. Altamira Cave in Spain. And a study like what I'm trying to do has been published on that site, receives about $7 million per year. There have been studies of other caves around the world, and it tends to be around, say, $30,000 per year is received on things like entrance receipts and associated items.
Wow, you're talking about huge potential for economic benefit, right?
Yeah, and it's sustainable, isn't it? It's long term because these sites, you know, a cave and a blue hole, it's a long term feature of the landscape. It's going to be there for, you know, for centuries, millennia. And so if we in the Bahamas and everywhere around the world, you know, if we can conserve them well, then. And the good thing about Nassau is, you know, most tourists do arrive to Nassau, don't they? You know, it's the main airport hub. It's the main port for tourists. And, you know, like Andros, that's got a Blue Holes National Park, which, you know, is fantastic. It's well preserved, as all of the national parks are. But, there are some very interesting sites in New Providence as well, and it's just easily accessible, isn't it, for the tourists that come here, and an extra draw for that.
You've been doing these studies, I would say, all over the world. What are some of the more fascinating revelations that you've made as you've really investigated this, what I call this intriguing kind of ecosystem, right? Caves and blue holes.
Like whenever I travel somewhere, I always try to visit a cave. Even where I grew up as well, there are some caves. And I think, you know, like I did my PhD on the third largest cave in the world, Naya Cave. So that was the first major eye-opener. You know, it's vast. It's a 200-meter wide entrance, 70 meters high. And, you know, we would explore the different passages. I remember seeing large crickets. These are these large insects, but giant ones, like the size of a rugby ball, like the size of a football, kind of scurrying around on the ground. Large bats. I saw snakes. And then interestingly, some of the published studies of scientists that study fossils, they find remains of creatures that used to live there in the past, you know, things like crocodiles. So even in the Bahamian blue holes, there are published studies of the fossils of crocodiles and giant turtles and things like that.
I do recall some of the archaeological kind of artifacts that were found in blue holes in the Bahamas that were featured in that wonderful feature expose that was published in the National Geographic magazine.
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah, there's been some great work done on the, particularly on the blue holes, on the fossil deposits. You know, as I mentioned, those animals that don't exist now, but gives us an insight into that natural history. And but also, you know, at Lukayen Caves, there has been some, I believe, some human remains from the Lukayens have been found there, and some of the kind of tools that they were using. And there has been a study of a cave at Clifton on New Providence. I think this was published back in the 1970s, of some kind of artifacts found there, like some kind of pottery and that kind of thing.
So I, as you're speaking, I'm thinking about how important of a role a university serves and plays, a sacred role, really, when it comes to research in terms of telling us more about ourselves and adding the kind of information that can positively impact our trajectory that could be transformational. Talk about the role that a university has in a society, in a nation, to the world.
Yeah, it's crucial, because this is the place where you know, people can come and learn about You know, typically people choose what they want to study. So that in itself is a beautiful thing, isn't it? Where we can try and follow our instincts, our interests, our dreams even. We might dream of even, you know, becoming something in society that first requires studying, you know, a related topic. And a place where, you know, we can do that in a comfortable environment. You know, think of the University of the Bahamas. It's got a wonderful library, lots of resources, lots of books, but also online as well, lots of materials. And then universities are so critical for just helping people to, you know, give them that outlet to pursue their interests, but also, you know, to be educated in necessary subjects for a nation, in things like environmental science, geography, and then, you know, all the sciences, biology, chemistry, physics, and then you go into your applied sciences as well, and also maths, engineering, and then into your humanities, you know, your history, sociology, and then you've got, you know, human sciences, psychology, nursing, medical care, and then as related to this study, you know, economics, business studies. So, you know, you name it, all of the topics that are necessary for a functioning society. And then there's a place where, you know, future leaders can, you know, develop themselves and be influenced by professors. And I think also crucially is to make good contacts, you know, with your classmates, your peers. And you know, as for myself, you know, I've managed to keep in touch with many of my good friends I made at university, and quite often I think they do become lifelong friends and also contacts, and you know, it can be really helpful in your career and pursuing your interests.
Speaking of interests, what's the level of interest from the students that you come into contact with within the university system about going into the direction of research and the natural environment and ecosystems and geography and related disciplines?
I think there's fantastic interest. Like many of the students, that they're very keen, you know, to, and I've been really impressed at how they're able to choose a project, you know, that they find interesting. Quite often that's the case, rather than, you know, the professor giving them a project. Quite often they come up with something that they're interested in. And so it's great to see. And then usually the project goes well in that case, where, you know, a student feels that they've got some self-interest in it. You know, they feel kind of committed to that particular project. And yeah, in terms of the natural sciences, yeah, we get a lot of interest. I think you know, as we're all becoming aware about this ecological crisis on the planet, you know, the large numbers of species that are disappearing around the world on a daily basis, you know, we see in the headlines the issues of climate and environmental change. And so naturally, I think you know, the students are aware of it and want to do a project that ties into that to enable their understanding, and also to try and contribute something with the results. And also some disciplines might not be that easy to actually do a project. And so sometimes we get students also who want to do an environmental project, even though they might not want to go and work in that area, but they know that they can find a topic that's of personal interest to them, and also that the project is actually going to work because they know that the data, they can obtain it, and you know, the project is you know, it's got a good potential, you know, and such things like, there's less ethical concerns with some projects than others. So, you know, imagine a medical student wants to do a project on a, you know, they can't just go and do a medical procedure. You know, there's lots of ethical concerns with that. And so an ecological project where you're also studying a natural system such as a blue hole, where you know there is a natural, say, flushing of water, like in an organism, and using scientific equipment. Still, they learn analytical skills that are useful in many disciplines.
Wow, we've had such a journey talking about this interesting subject matter of caves and blue holes, their worth, their value, how we interact with them, what's our responsibility as stewards, developing new knowledge and using that information to make wiser decisions in terms of development and moving forward. As we wrap up the show now, because we are flat out of time, what kind of wrap-up comments do you have that you would like to leave with our listeners?
Yeah, just to provide a kind of an overview, I guess, of I've been able to kind of share my enthusiasm for these sites and how beneficial they can be. I know sometimes, for example, the local community, they feel some kind of closeness to the site. So I know the Mermaid's Pool Blue Hole, it's got even got its own nickname. They call it the MIM in Golden Gates. And then for us to try and do our best to preserve these sites and also with these sites and nature in general, for us to do our best to protect it, to feel responsible for it as stewards. And also, if anyone is interested to study at UB, I strongly encourage you. And if you're interested in natural environment, ecology, geography, it's a very beneficial area to get into. This is the big challenge of this century is environmental protection. And there are lots of opportunities, particularly where, if somebody has a natural interest in this area, it can take you a long way. And at the same time, you feel good about it because, you're doing something that you just know that it's so important for society and the planet.
That is absolutely true, and that's a perfect note on which to end this episode of University Drive. Thank you so very much, Dr. Mark Stevens, Associate Professor of Geography at University of the Bahamas. Our listeners, thank you so much for joining us. Don't forget to stay connected with University of the Bahamas. Make sure that you visit our website, www.ub.edu.bs. And also follow us and subscribe on our social media sites on Facebook, on YouTube, on Instagram, LinkedIn. Just stay connected. Thank you so much for joining us for this episode of University Drive. I've been your host, Tamika Lundy. Join us again next time for a compelling new episode.
University Drive is a production of the Office of University Relations at University of the Bahamas. All rights reserved.